In terms of decision making for an upper GI cancer, which is bleeding, our established therapies, our established modalities, even our established algorithms don't work.
Welcome to the ESGE podcast, Endoscopy Unplugged. Join us each month to hear the latest from European experts and where we'll discuss relevant clinical topics and provide you with tips and tricks, practical scientific evidence, and pearls of wisdom to inform your endoscopy practice. So please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join us as we advance GI endoscopy care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 6 of ESGE's podcast, Endoscopy Unplugged. My name is Ian Grelnick, past president of the ESG, and I am your host. Today's podcast is entitled Crisis Management 101, Endoscopic Hemostasis for Peptic Ulcer Bleeding, and my guest is Dr. John Morris, consultant gastroenterologist at the Glasgow Royal Infirmary in Glasgow, Scotland. John is a senior author of many original publications in upper GI bleeding and is a co-author on the ESG guideline on peptic ulcer bleeding, Update 2026, where he has served as a task force lead. That ESGE guideline was published online last month. So congratulations, John, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ian.
Great to have you here. Now, before we start, I want to ask you, how did you decide to pursue a career in GI endoscopy?
Well, as I look back, I was training as a physician and I had to decide which subspecialty to train in. I liked the intellectual stimulation of being a physician and analyzing the issues in front of me, but I very much appreciated the opportunity for hands-on treatment, and I could clearly see the future for minimally invasive treatments and the opportunity for endoscopy to make a material difference to quality of life. So for me, it was actually quite an easy choice.
Same for me, likewise. But let's get to endoscopic management of peptic ulcer bleeding. So you have a patient, John, who is having an upper GI bleed from a peptic ulcer, whether it's gastric or duodenal. And one of my questions is, what scopes do you recommend we should be using in that situation? Is it a diagnostic gastroscope, therapeutic scope?
Well, Ian, this has actually evolved over time for me, because previously we would have used a dual channel endoscope, but with the more modern gastroscopes with the larger working channels, our go-to endoscope is a 3.8 millimeter working channel. I think it's really important that these endoscopes have got the water wash capability built in, so that you can clearly see the pathology that you're trying to identify. So these days, it's a therapeutic gastroscope, single channel, that I prefer.
I'm right there with you. We have a single channel therapeutic scope. We also have a double channel. When I give talks, and I've heard you say the same thing, I really think in this situation with peptic ulcer bleeding, we should not be using a diagnostic size channel gastroscope. Because we're just not going to be able to use large size tools. They're just not going to fit down the working channel of a diagnostic scope.
Yeah, and I think it's all about the right endoscope.
Agree. All right, so you're there. You've realized this is peptic ulcer bleeding. In terms of the force classification, who are you going to deliver endoscopic hemostasis to?
Well, for me, we very much adhere and agree with the international guidelines. So it's the force 1A, 1B, and 2A, absolutely. For me, I think it's very obvious that we should also be treating the forest 2B lesions. And I suspect that's probably a group internationally that are undertreated and perhaps could be treated better.
So you're talking about the adherent clot, the non-bleeding adherent clot patients.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. I'm with you. The only caveat is that I think that if you are going to treat those adherent clots, you need to be ready for things starting to bleed, that you could unleash a torrential bleed. And if you're ready for that and you feel capable with your endoscopic skills, I agree with you. I would treat those types of patients. But let's talk about active bleeding. So let me know, what's your go-to endoscopic hemostasis therapy if you have a Forest 1A or a Forest B bleeder?
Well, this is actually an evolving area for me, Ian, as you know. But I still adhere to the wisdom of dual endoscopic therapy. There is no room for monotherapy, particularly with simply epinephrine or adrenaline injection. So I would use adrenaline injection plus a heater probe or a gold probe, but also endoscopic clips. There's a lot of decision-making goes into which modality, depending on the lead and the ease of access to deliver the therapy.
So when you inject with epinephrine, you're injecting dilute epinephrine. What's your concentration that you're using?
Yeah, so we're using 1 in 10,000. I think the biggest mistake that people make is that they're far too timid with the volume that they use. So I have no hesitation in using at least 13 to 15 mils, but actually I could easily see myself using more, up to 20 mils, 25 mils. The important factor here is not to make your access to the bleeding lesion worse as a result of infection.
Right.
It's about where are you going to inject, how much are you going to inject, and clear communication with the team.
So where are you injecting?
So I actually would tend to, for example, if you think about either a posterior duodenal wall ulcer or high lesser curve, I'll tend to inject downstream, so in the more distal part of the lesion, and I'm injecting around the periphery in hopefully four separate quadrants, and then probably I will also inject into the center of the lesion at that point. We have to make a compromise, because if we inject and make the visible lesion more difficult to treat, either with a clip or with the probes, then perhaps we're doing a disservice. So I think it is a judgment call.
So if you're going to use, let's say, a through the scope clip as your combination therapy, are you doing that in, I mean, how do you choose if you're going to use actually a through the scope clip or even an over the scope clip as that second hemostasis therapy?
So this is where the evolution has come, Ian. And you know, I think all of us are now very much aware of the significant impact that over-the-scope clipping, the evidence does support the use of these in first-line therapy. But with all endoscopic therapies, you have to adjust your therapeutic armamentarium according to the anatomical position and also the technical skills required. So for example, if you have a D1, D2 or posterior ulcer, maybe not the best for OTSC clip. If I'm going to use an over-the-cap-mounted clip, I may actually tend to use less injection therapy because I feel I'm going to get a really good tissue acquisition with that clip. So in that situation, I use a minimal amount of adrenaline injection to facilitate the sucking of the pathology into the cap, but I don't want to obscure the pathology and make my life more difficult. I may actually go for a cap-mounted clip, actually go for monotherapy.
Even if it's actively bleeding, you're not going to try and slow it down even a little bit with some dilute epi?
Well, that's my point. So a small amount of adrenaline just to give yourself a clear view of where the bleeding lesion is. But actually, you know, these are very effective therapies now. So if we can control this on a sort of, you know, single modality approach, I'm happy with that.
Yeah, and I especially like them in these larger fibrotic ulcers where I find oftentimes the through-the-scope clips are just not strong enough and that you really need the strength of a cap-mounted clip to take care of it. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the critical thing was when we evaluate the evidence, we need to appreciate that some of the studies that were done on cap-mounted clips actually selected the lesion to use the cap-mounted clip on. So when we interpret the literature, we have to be a little cautious about firstly, the primary hemostatic success, but secondly, long-term hemostasis. But yeah, I mean, I think this is a really attractive technology, particularly as we know that our standard endoscopic therapy, even in the best hands, will fail to control bleeding up to 10, maybe 15% of the time, depending on the lesion that we are identifying.
Is there a learning curve with cap-mounted clips, in your opinion?
Well, I think there's a lot of mystique around the use of the cap-mounted clips. And I would say to people listening that actually, if you can use a variceal band ligator, then actually the technology is remarkably similar. I do think that we are perhaps in an era where specific either training courses for endoscopic hemostasis or some demonstrable competency it should be required before using the clips.
I'm an advocate that I think we should absolutely have these as part of our armamentarium or in our toolbox in our endoscopy suites for sure today to use in GI bleeding. Let me ask you something else because I get asked this question. Non-bleeding visible vessel or a Forest 2A lesion, do you pre-inject around that area with dilute epinephrine or just do some type of a monotherapy?
Well, I'm aware of the guidelines on this and also I have experience where actually you can make it more difficult to deliver the therapy. For me, if you're going to deliver mechanical therapy, it's much less necessary to inject adrenaline. But by habit, I have always usually injected some adrenaline as an adjunct. And remember, Ian, that I think we have to understand the pathology of peptic ulcers in that we're not dealing with an end artery, which is coming, in the sense like a julefoy, which is coming straight through the mucosa. Often these are lesions which are running parallel. The vessel is running parallel to the surface.
Let me go back to something because you had talked about using contact thermal therapies. If you're going to use a heater probe or you're going to use a bipolar probe, what are the settings? How do you approach utilizing? Because I sometimes find with the younger generation, they're actually not even that familiar with contact thermal probes, but some of us older people like you and I, we're trained on those types of modalities.
Our go-to when we were sort of beginning this journey in endoscopic hemostasis was the heater probe. Unfortunately, we no longer have that available, but we're using injection gold probe. The beauty here is that, as we've highlighted, anatomy can be critical to success of endoscopic therapy. The beauty is that you can get a degree of tangential application of pressure that will actively coagulate the vessel. Really important point you make here about the amount of power. Firstly, we modify the power settings in the duodenum compared to the stomach. Usually, my experience is that gastric ulcers have a more chronic and indurating base. So I'm probably using the region of 30 watts of power, whereas in the duodenum, 20, 25. So I'm using less heat in the duodenum. It's very thin walled. And you see that at laparotomies that actually you can very often see where you've been delivering therapy through the wall of the duodenum. So you have to be careful when applying heat in that situation.
And when you're trying to apply coaptive coagulation and you're pushing down, right, and you're using these watts, how long are you holding the probe there in place?
I want to see a footprint. It's really important. So it's probably going to be 2 or 3 seconds with the gold probe. Actually, of course, with the heater probe, there was a natural duration of when you hit the foot switch, there was a natural duration, and then it stopped.
That's right. It would automatically turn off.
Yeah,
that's
but right. I mean, I have, and again, you know, bleeding peptic ulcer, if we discuss it with surgeons, they'll say, look, there's very little between a bleeding peptic ulcer and a bleeding peptic ulcer with a perforation. You know, there's very thin tissue indeed.
You do need to be careful, but again, you need to apply coaptive coagulation. Yeah. So let me change gears a little bit to another type of hemostasis modality that's come along. So what about topical agents or powders or gels? Where, in your opinion, do they fit today in peptic ulcer bleeding? And what does the literature tell us? What's the evidence?
So I think we're at a quite an important point in the journey in the use of hemostatic powders. As you know, we were very fortunate here in Glasgow to be amongst the first in the world to be able to use topical hemostats. It makes sense because, firstly, they're very attractive in terms of their ease of use. They're fairly simple, and the ability to deliver has improved considerably. So we absolutely supported the use of hemostatic powders in two contexts. One, as a rescue therapy, and secondly, particularly in patients who've got bleeding upper GI cancers. Because as you know, in terms of decision-making for an upper GI cancer, which is bleeding, can be a real problem. Our established therapies, our established modalities, even our established algorithms don't work. You can make things a lot worse. So we saw some spectacular success with this. And as you know, the RCTs have shown superiority of hemostatic powders in cancer bleeding. I think that's, for me, it's an argument that is won. That should be first line. What I think is really important to appreciate is part of the literature that we've looked at as part of the 2026 guideline update, there's this increasing sense that actually, if we look at the generalizability of the techniques we've talked about and the skill set that's required to deliver those techniques, perhaps there may be a role for these hemostatic powders as first-line therapy. Now, that makes me nervous because intuitively, if we have a forest 1A, 1B lesion, then are we seriously thinking they will have enough hemostatic impact to actually stop that vessel from bleeding or indeed rebleeding? But actually, when you look at the meta-analysis that we reviewed as part of the 2026 guideline, they stack up well because of the ease of use and the technical challenges that every day we face. However, I would urge those people listening to dig deeper into the literature because the literature clearly highlights a lot of these meta-analyses do not separate peptic ulcer bleed from cancer bleed. It's a general statement that it should be a first-line therapy. So intuitively, you would think we should change the guideline, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we have a qualified acceptance that the paradigm may shift. There may be lesions where topical powder first-line is best, and there may be endoscopists where actually it would be in the patient's best interest for topical therapy. I think in 2026, the jury still remains, in my view, out, although I think we are at the point where we should be moving these further forward in the algorithm. I saw a very neat paper recently, actually, and let me just highlight this, which was the addition of a hemostatic powder after successful endoscopic therapy. We do recognize that whilst we talk about dual endoscopic therapy, sometimes actually we extend that to triple therapy. And for me, that recent paper, which suggested a topical hemostat post-successful endoscopic therapy may have additional benefits was very attractive. And so it's just a question looking clearly about what was the modality that was used as the primary hemostatic agent. And that's where that just fell down a little bit for me, because actually they weren't using dual therapy, they were using monotherapy with heat. So although they had hemostasis, I'm not sure we can generalize that. The jury's out, but I think the hemostatic patterns are moving up the algorithm.
Well, I think if truth were to be told, and to be honest with you, I've done this myself on occasion. I actually have thrown powder on after I've delivered what I thought was adequate hemostasis therapy, just because I think sometimes you sleep better at night if you think you've added something on there. And I think that that goes on more than we think.
And I suspect as well, there's the conscious competence element of GI bleeding that you and I
know, exactly.
When something has been treated and is very unlikely to rebleed. And then we know there are other lesions where we've struggled to get hemostasis, where we think we've done our best,
yep,
you know, for the limitations that we've described. And other than the potential expense of an additional therapy, that makes sense. We don't treat lesions, we treat patients.
It's a good point. But let's say, what do you do when things are just not, you're not able to treat something endoscopically? What do you do at that point? Who do you pick up the phone and call next?
This is a really important thing. For me, it's about the scenario. Are we under control? Is the patient hemodynamically stable? So this is a teamwork. If I have a patient who's had massive GI bleeding that I've struggled to get endoscopic therapy, often a priori beforehand, before I carry out that endoscopy, I'll speak to my surgical team and say, look, I'm going to try to stop this bleeding, but I'm pretty clear, given, for example, extremely high Blatchford, the ongoing resuscitation need, this is going to be a high-risk lesion. And so can we make sure that if it all comes to the point where we cannot control bleeding, and in my career, I have seen people requiring immediate surgery to save their life, then the team is already alerted. We make a lot of tests of arterial embolization, which is very effective therapy, but there's a number of factors that guidelines, I think, don't take into account, such as the availability out of hours of radiologists skilled enough to deliver arterial embolization. How close are you with that patient to an IR suite? Because if we get to a point where the patient's clinically unstable, it becomes actually unsafe to put them into a radiology suite. It's safer for them to be in theater and to get stabilization. Remember, the bleeding does stop. And so as long as we can get control of resuscitation with the appropriate input from colleagues in intensive care, there's nothing to be lost by starting that patient on PPI and waiting to see what happens clinically. Because bleeding does come and go, and it's not inconceivable that you would say, I can't deal with this at the moment. I'm going to give this patient a PPI, but I feel if I could go back in 12 hours or 24 hours, as long as this patient's stable, then I will have a second attempt endoscopically.
Do you have 24-hour-a-day IR coverage?
We do. We have it actually in one of our neighboring hospitals, but the IR team will come to our hospital. Unfortunately, my experience with that has been that often our interventional radiologists, firstly, they will ask for a CT angio first line.
So that's, right.
If you have a critical illness situation, that has not, in my opinion, been helpful. But secondly,
just because you're worried about them doing bad things during the CT,
because it's delaying it's delaying the therapy.
Yeah.
The second thing is that we need to be really clear, unless you have a very experienced interventional radiologist who's used to doing this, actually selectively targeting the vessel that we wish them to target can be very challenging, for example, in the duodenum. Remember, in the stomach, there's a rich anastomotic network of arteries coming on the lesser curve and greater curve. So it's been highlighted to me by colleagues in IR that actually simply asking them to embolize in a very selective way can be quite challenging.
When a patient, let's say that endoscopic therapy is just not working, and you're going to pick up the phone and call IR, before you pick up that phone, though, and you know the endoscopic site from where it's bleeding from, are you placing a clip there to help guide the radiologist, give them a roadmap?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the other thing about bleeding from any lesion, particularly peptic ulcers, is it's intermittent. And so the ease with which a radiologist can actually identify the bleeding site depends on actually the site bleeding. So it can be really quite challenging for them. But we've actually had quite a number of experiences where IR colleagues did try to embolize, couldn't find the bleeding spot, or thought they'd embolize the bleeding spot, and then the patient rebleeds. And we never talk about rebleeding post-IR particularly.
I agree with you. We had a case very similar to that just a few weeks ago. And patient had rebleeding, and we went back in endoscopically and stopped it. At your hospital, do you have 24/7 emergency endoscopy services available for bleeders.
Yes, we do.
And I think that that's really should be standard. In my opinion, all over the world, guidelines have been talking about that now for at least 10 to 15 years, that needs to be a service that hospitals provide.
Yeah. Actually, I think you need someone who's skilled to deliver that therapy, who's doing it on a regular basis. I do think that we're getting to a point where actually we should be saying, what's the optimum number of gastroenterologists, it could be surgeons, who should be on an on-call rota such that they remain skilled in delivery of these endoscopic therapies. If you have 30 people, if you think about it, Ian, our hospital will admit 400 patients with upper GI bleeding. About 25% of those will require an intervention. If we have 10 gastroenterologists on call to deliver therapy, then on average per annum, there may be a really small number of episodes where endoscopic therapy is delivered by an individual person. So the risk of de-skilling is there, but actually using new technology also becomes challenging because how do they become familiar with that? So my view, and I think you've heard me saying this before, is that I think that hospitals need to decide the optimum number, but it shouldn't be the entire GI or surgical team. And as you know, we've seen something similar in Paris, where the endoscopist and the fellow travel around in a number of hospitals to deliver therapy. I mean, that's a brilliant model.
In a taxi, they travel around.
That's right. Maybe it's cheaper to go by taxi in Paris than it is in Glasgow.
Well, we had a hemostasis team at UCLA when I was there, and they've had, I don't know if they still do, they used to have a hemostasis or a bleeding team at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, but that's not the common, let me tell you. And I agree with what you're saying. And there's a lot of attendings that take emergency call who don't feel comfortable treating GI bleeding just because they don't see enough of it.
Yeah, we identified this in the UK some time ago, and we started a dedicated one-day GI bleeding course that was for trainees and established consultants. And ironically, the biggest number of people who subscribed to this were established consultants or attendings, because at least if you have the insight to realize that there are new technologies that you can deliver better care, then you probably make a better person to be on a GI bleeding rota.
Just tell everybody, all of our listeners, how do you give your PPI post-therapy and for how long?
Well, like you, I was almost trained on the Hong Kong, so-called Hong Kong protocol, which was IV PPI post-procedure for anyone who'd had endoscopic therapy. The real issue with that for me has been the fact that in the current healthcare environment we're in, that it confines the patient to hospital. So I think more recently we've switched to high-dose oral PPI twice daily. I'm pretty convinced that of the equivalence of those, and particularly for patients where you're very happy, there's a low risk of rebleed, than high-dose OPPI, which can then be taken on discharge.
But you put them on like 24 hours afterwards? You keep them in-house for 24 hours, then transition them?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So if we've intervened endoscopically, and it's a really important point, is when do you refeed someone? When can you allow them to have a meal? And my view is really simple. If you have convinced yourself that you've delivered endoscopic therapy and the patient can eat and go back to normal activities after 24 hours. But if there's any doubt where you're unsettled, patient's perhaps been stable, but there's high risk features, then perhaps keeping that patient fasted a little longer is not a bad idea in case you have to do a second endoscopy.
Yeah, we usually don't keep patients for 72 hours. We either will put them initially for 24 hours, but then you can also give them sort of BID dosing of IV if you want to, or put them on the high dose orals afterwards and send them out if it's possible and they don't have any other severe comorbidities that would keep them in the hospital at that point.
I think that's a trend that we'll see more of. The reality is that the equivalence studies that have been done for me are pretty reassuring.
Yeah, absolutely. Last issue I wanted to talk to you about. So peptic ulcer bleed, tell me how you approach testing and treating H. pylori. Are you taking a biopsy during that endoscopy? What are you doing? Are you doing rapid urease testing? Are you sending an actual biopsy for histology? Because I get that question all the time.
I'm really glad you mentioned this one because it is something that somewhat frustrates me, because we understand that if we have blood in the stomach, it may affect the accuracy of the urease test. So my view is very pragmatic. Absolutely take a biopsy for rapid urease testing, because if it's positive, then the patient will receive Helicobacter eradication and then can have a urine breath test at an interval post-discharge to ensure that they've had Helicobacter eradication.
Which is really important to document if they've had a complicated ulcer.
Correct. However, if you take a urease test and it's negative, and that patient should be booked for an early urease test to to check if they are actually positive.
So here's what I do, or what my department does, because this is what I've asked them to do. So I do the rapid urease test, but at the same time, I take additional couple of bites and put it in a histology bottle. And if the rapid urease test is negative, I send it for histology to see, because I'm not always convinced that the patients will come back and do the breath testing or stool testing afterwards. And I'm worried, just like I'm worried that we need to document eradication of H. pylori because they've bled from a peptic ulcer, and I really want to make sure if they're positive, they're going to get treated. That's what we do. And the other thing is, if the rapid urease test is positive, we actually recommend them starting antibiotic therapy, especially if they're going to stay in the hospital for a few days. We start them already on antibiotics.
Yeah. What you're describing is a very pragmatic approach, taking into account your population adherence. We understand that patients may not come for outpatient follow-up. Afterward.
So, yeah.
That's kind of a neat solution. I haven't used that before.
Yeah. And if their rapid urease test is positive, I throw away the histology bottle. I waste a bottle, but I guess that's the price we pay for that pragmatic approach. All right. Well, listen, John, I think we've come to the end of our podcast here. I want to thank you again very much for being here. Having an international expert like you on this podcast talking about hemostasis and peptic ulcer bleeding is fantastic. I don't know if you know, I'm a big sports fan. I follow my Minnesota sports teams, the Twins and the Minnesota Vikings in football. I just wanted to ask you so our listeners can get a little bit more of a background on who John Morris is. Do you play sports or do you have favorite sports teams? What do you guys do in Scotland up there in Glasgow?
Yeah, I play sports. I'm pretty fanatical about the outdoors, Ian. So for me, it's skiing and windsurfing.
Wow.
I travel around the world doing these, and it's fantastic to be out there in nature.
And I know you're a golfer. I know we both are golfers. So hopefully one day we'll get a game in together in the future. But listen, thank you again for being here. It's been wonderful to have you, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Endoscopy Unplugged. If you found this podcast useful, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To find out more about the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, for example, to browse our scientific publications, interact with our online learning portal, the ESG Academy, or learn about becoming a member of ESGE, visit our website, www.esge.com. And of course, your feedback is always valuable to us. So send us your thoughts via podcast@esge.com. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.